Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 152. And in the last lesson, we covered the last episode in the chapter where Abraham is being told about his brother, and that is his wife, the wife of his brother, with his children. And his brother was Nahor. And he still lived back in the old country in Haran, a land that was named after his brother that died in the Ur of the Chaldeans before they came up north on the way to Canaan. And God is mentioning several names here, and generally when God injects some kind of information there, it is because it has a link to the story. It has a link to his own people. In this case, it has a link to Rebekah, the wife, the future wife of the son of Abraham, Isaac, and also several family members that also later on will come into contact and have links with the people of Israel in later days. And so we mentioned about Betuel, who was the father of Rebekah in verse 23. And also in verse 22, he refers to the names, he speaks about the names of Milcah, the wife of Nahor. The firstborn was Uz. And remember, later on, you read the story of Job, and Job was from this area, the land of Oz, Uz. In other words, Uz, who was the firstborn of Milcah, lived in a certain territory, and the manner of the time was, you become a patriarch, you call the land after your name, and then all the people that come from there are referred by that name. And so, very possibly, since Uz was the firstborn, he had that land there, and then one of the descendants of Uz later on is Job himself, which means he is Job, a relative of Abraham from the old days. And then there is Booz, the second brother, and then there is Kemuel. And it's interesting, with every one of the first sons, they just mentioned the name, Uz and then Booz, but when it comes to the third son, Kemuel, it is mentioned that he is the father of Aram. Now, why inject this name, Aram? Well, as time went by, there was a land there called Aram, and Laban lived in that land. Laban was called Laban the Aramean. In other words, he lived in the land of Aram. So apparently Laban, that was born later on to Betuel, was another brother of this that were already mentioned, all children of Milcah. And apparently Aram had his own territory there, and he called the land where he was Aram, and so Betuel was born there, and so Betuel is born, Laban is born there, who is the son of Betuel, the brother of Aram, and so he's called Laban of the Aramean. And Aram later on came into prominence in his dealings with the children of Israel, because Aram was in that area that later on became known as Syria, but in biblically speaking, the area is called Aram, and the people there obviously called Aramim, or Aramean, in the English. And that territory was up north there, and apparently God brought them, and you know, as they lived in that territory, they spread all around there, but God brought a part of them, apparently, closer to the border of Israel, and for a purpose. Now, mind you, all these, more or less, are relatives, brothers, cousins, nieces, nephews, and as time goes by, of Abraham, who is also the father of Israel. And so you see, in essence, that God is situating people around Israel who are also relatives from Father Abraham. On the west, on the east side, that is, he brought Lot, and Lot finally ended up there, and God gave him that land. And Lot had two sons, and the sons were Moab and Ammon, and they certainly became enemies of Israel, and sometimes friends, but nevertheless, relatives of Israel. And then down further, Edom, the brother of Jacob, he had that land there, and he too had much problems with the children of Israel, and back and forth. And so you see on the eastern board, on the eastern side of the land of Israel, they were all children of Abraham, or related to Abraham. between Lot and Edom. And then up north, you find Aram, which is also a relative of Abraham, from this Aram, the son of Kemuel, the son of Milcah and Nahor, who was the brother of Abraham. And then to the south, you see later on, as time went by, the Egyptians, and Ishmael was an Egyptian. In other words, his mother was an Egyptian. His father, yes, was Abraham, and so he was half and half, so to speak, half Egyptian. But then his mother took an Egyptian woman to Ishmael, and so now his children are three-quarters Egyptian, and then they take other Egyptians, and pretty soon they're all Egyptians. You see? And so in the south, you end up with Ishmael. On the east, you find Esau and Moab and Ammon, all relatives, all either children or relatives of Abraham. And then up north, you find Aram, again, a relative of Abraham. And the only exception is the Philistines that God brought into that territory from Kaphtor, as we mentioned in the last lesson in the book of Amos, where God mentions that he brought the Philistines from Kaphtor, and they were Canaanites, and they were actually also related to the people in the south, Egypt. And then also he brought Aram from Kir. And Aram is basically what you read here, Kemuel, the father of Aram. And from that came later on the Arameans. I like to use this name to this very day, Aram. It's very common among them. And then also a part of them were brought up north to the border of Israel, and they had constant dealings with Israel, either good or bad. Sometimes they had alliances. Oftentimes they were just at enmity with them. And nowadays you see a mixture of this Arameans or Aram in the land of Syria. Of course, Syria was renamed by the Greeks. It was not the original name. And so to this very day, it's Aram in Hebrew, though they call it Syria also, following the example, you know, of the Greeks, and what it became known in history is Syria all these years. And so you find a mixture there, as I mentioned earlier in the last lesson, of Assyrians from Ashur that remained in that territory. And so also I mentioned, concerning a different subject, about Assyria, that Abraham himself, later on, as we are going to read about it, when he remarried, and he had his wife Keturah, and from her the grandson was also called Ashur, or Ashurim in the plural. And Josephus tells us that after this Ashurim, who was a grandson of Abraham, the land of Assyria was named after him, you see. And so these people later on migrated along with the other Assyrians, or different Assyrians, and they migrated into Northwest Europe, and the Assyrians that became the Germans ended up, you know, in modern-day Germany, and the other Assyrians that were from the grandchild of Abraham, they ended up in Austria. But some of them remained behind, and so we find a mixture today in Syria, in Aram. Present-day Syria, that is biblically Aram, we find Assyrians from Assyria that went into present-day Germany, and then we find the Assyrians, remnant of Assyrians, who were from Ashurim, the son, the grandson of Abraham, who also, some of them, that is, many of them, are still there. And then, of course, you find also the traces of a leftover from the Hamitic races. So you find sort of a mixture when you go to Syria. And the ones that is dominating today the land of Syria, there is a small group that dominates, and the former president that just died, Assad, and of course his son, Bashar, is not going to be the president. Well, they come from this minority, which, ironically, they are related to Abraham, grandchild of Abraham, and also some of them probably from the other Assyrian that remained behind, that went into Germany. So you find a mixture of people there. And anyway, when God records this kind of names here, there is a background there, and then we continue to study the story, and then you see why those names were mentioned and why God, through Moses here, is recording the history of this people, at least a mention of them, because later on you'll read more about them. So nothing that you find in the Bible is just because God was trying to fill space. Everything has a lot of meaning, and as you continue, as you study, you know, as Solomon says, God has his word and it is hidden, but it is the glory of the king to dig very deeply into it. And so as we study the word of God deeply and search and research and study and understand, put things together, hopefully led by the Holy Spirit, then we can illuminate our eyes to a much greater knowledge and understanding of certain names and certain places that were mentioned, and later on we find out what they are all about. And so whenever we study the Bible, we should always keep that in mind. Nothing in the Word of God is meaningless. Everything has something to do with basically the plan of God, the people of Israel, his dealings with his own people. And so we'll continue now to chapter 23, as we began last time. Now, Sarah is dying. We read in verse 1, and the life of Sarah was 127 years. So she was 127. That's a biblical way of counting. First the 100, and then comes the 10, 20, 30, whatever, and then come the individual years. And she was 127, which means Abraham was at this time 137, because earlier we read that when Abraham was 90, his wife was 80, and that's when they were wondering about having children. And so she at this point is 127 and she dies, and Abraham is 137, which means that when Abraham was 100, Isaac was born. So now Isaac is 37 years old. And just short time before that, we don't know exactly when, 2, 3, 4 years, we read about the events in chapter 22, when God requested of Abraham to offer his son on Mount Moriah. And so obviously, Isaac at that time was not a little lad. He was a child, you know, he was not a little boy, even though he's called a lad, and that is a nar. But then in Hebrew, in ancient terminology, when you are in the 70s, those who are in the 30s are called children. In other words, ne'arim, boys. Not children, but boys. And so you can see that this boy was not a little boy in our terminology, but he was in his 30s, and probably, very probably, since he's a symbolic and type of Jesus Christ, he could have been 33. Just like Jesus Christ was when he was crucified. And so that's quite an interesting point there. But anyway, he was in his 30s. And now he's 37 and his mother is dying. That is, she died. And verse 2, we read, and Sarah died in Kiryat Arba. The same is Hebron. In other words, the city of what we know today as Hebron or Hebron. Hebron means Haver comes from that, friend. And also to put things, you know, you put things together, you say Lehaber. So maybe that territory there was a land that was connected to other areas, and so that name came about. Anyway, whichever is the case, the former name was Kiryat Arba. And the reason why it was Kiryat Arba, which means city of four, we read in Judges chapter 1 and verse 10 that the ancient name of Hebron was Kiryat Arba. And we also read that when Israel came into the land, they went on a conquest of the land with Joshua. And in this particular area, they killed three giants who were chieftains. And they were all the sons of Arba. Arba means four. Why was it called four? We don't know. Perhaps like some other giants, there were other giants that I mentioned elsewhere who had six fingers and six toes. Maybe this guy had only four fingers and four toes. Whichever is the case, he was called Arba, and this is where she died. And apparently, Abraham in the meantime moved from Beersheba, where he was, during the time when he took Isaac on that trip to Jerusalem, later on Jerusalem, Mount Moriah, and now he moved to Kiryat Arba, or Hebron, and so he finds himself in this area, and she dies here, so he needs to bury her. And this was in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah, and to weep for her. And you read it in English, you miss something in between, because a part of the culture is that when you read this terminology, you know that the custom of mourning for the dead included a ceremony, included all those people that were hired oftentimes to do the wailing, you know, and the mourning, and you know, if you have been to the Middle East, you know all the sounds that they make. And so you read over it, but if you live in the area, you can see the all the details around it. So there was a big ceremony there, and as a matter of fact, when you go to funerals in the Middle East, they're quite different than those here or elsewhere in other countries. It's a big, sort of a big, you cannot say celebration, but sometimes it always feels like it, because there is a 7 day of sitting there, and people come and bring food, and you sit and talk and all that, and you get the impression that it is a celebration, but it's not a celebration of joy, but of sadness, but of also of comforting the mourners. And so it may look like a celebration, but it's not. In either case, this is what Abraham is going through. And so he's sitting for 7 days, literally sitting on the ground. That's what I was accustomed to. I still do it today. I've been to some ceremonies like that, where for 7 days, this is what you have, and people come, and they all sit on the ground. They don't sit on chairs, because that's a part of the mourning. And they eat, and they talk, and they bring food, and you know, they have conversations, and oftentimes has nothing to do with the dead, so you get the impression it is a celebration. And so in verse 3, when we read, Abraham rose up from before his death, that's literally he rose up, because he was sitting for 7 days, now he rises up, you know, it's over. 7 days of mourning are over, and so he rises up, he stands up, and so these words are not, you know, spoken in vain. They're literally happening. He rises up after sitting for 7 days, and then when he is done with this part of the mourning period of the 7 days, we read, and he spoke unto the children of Heth, the Hittites, that lived there in this area, and some of them also lived in minor Asia, that is Turkey, and they created later on the Hittite Empire that also had relations with the Israelites. And if you remember the story of David and Bathsheba, she was married to Uriah the Hittite. So he was a Hittite from this Canaanite people. And also Solomon was dealing with the kings of the Hittites who lived in Asia, because they were raising horses. And he used to trade also with them in Egypt, getting horses. Anyway, these are the Hittites, a branch of the Canaanites. And he said to them, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Now mind you, Abraham knows very well that this land was promised to him. It is his land. Of course, these people don't know that, and he's not about to brag, you know, and act like he's the boss and things like that. You know, he's a man of humility. Yet he was a mighty man, also very, you know, well known throughout the whole territory, even before he came there, in Damascus, when he was there. Josephus tells us that he was already recognized there as a great prince, and he ruled over that area. And so he says to them, I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you. And that was an attitude that the fathers, even though they were promised this whole land and they knew it was theirs, they did not receive all those promises. And later on, the Apostle Paul would refer to this very state of mind of the patriarchs. And we read in Hebrews 11, you know, the Hall of Fame of the men of faith. It says about Abraham in verse 8, when God called him out of Mesopotamia, that is of actually of Haran, later on called Aram, the whole territory. And so we read by faith in verse 8 of chapter 11, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. So he knew that land was his. So in essence, from God's point of view and from Abraham's point of view, he's not really a sojourner there, or a stranger. That's his land. You're not a stranger in your own land. And yet, since he did not receive the promise yet, obviously, that's the way he lived his life. And he did not create any permanent residence wherever he was. He constantly traveled with his flocks. And he went out not knowing where he was going. In other words, he knew it was a land of Canaan, but didn't know exactly what part of Canaan. Some people don't understand that, the thing that he totally didn't know where he was going. He knew very well. Long before that, when God called him out of Ur of the Chaldean, he and his father, everybody knew they were going to the land of Canaan. But, you know, Canaan is from north to south, which part of it that he didn't know. And then we read by faith, verse 9, he dwelt in the land of promise. So it was his land, it was his inheritance, and yet he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country. And it's interesting, you know, it's your land, yet you dwell there as if you are a foreigner. And he did not go out on a conquest and saying, you know, this land is my land, you know, this is mine, God gave it to me, and therefore I'm taking over. Now, that's not the father of the faithful. And so he was dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. So they all know it's theirs, but you see, unlike other people, like Esau later on, as Isaac told him, you're going to get a promise, but you're going to have to get it by the sword. You see? With Jacob, God told him, I will give it to you. And when God goes in front of the armies of Israel, then Israel goes and conquers. And so all these people knew that whatever they do in life, all has to be based on the will of God. And so when, just like in the wilderness, when the cloud moves, Israel followed. When the cloud stayed, Israel stayed there, you know, and remained until the cloud took off. And so that was the attitude of the men of faith. And so that's a lesson for us too. We proceed, we go forward only with God, never without Him. And David later on, we read several times, and all the men of God and all the kings, whenever they went to war, the first question they asked is, God, will you be with me? Will you go with me? Will you go in front of me? Will you give me the victory? And if you don't, I'm not going to go out. You see? And we should learn from this example that in whatever thing that we do, as we do it unto the Lord, obviously the Lord has to be there. That's why later on in the New Testament you read about the parable of the rich man, that, you know, he was doing things on his own, and he got rich, and he says, well, I've got so much now, I've got to build myself barns and this and that. In other words, everything that he does was apart from God. And therefore, you know, you read in the proverb that God said, well, this day, this night, your life is going to be taken away from you. In other words, you have this kind of an attitude, you know, you have no need for me, I'm not in the forefront of you, as David would say, I've said, always the Lord before my face. Well, you're going to lose everything. And that's what James later on would say, that whatever you do, you know, say God's willing, you know, if the Lord wills, you know, we'll do this and this and that. But if you are not, you know, you're a wicked person. God is not in your life. Well, anyway, this is what we see here, this attitude. And so, in verse 10, we see the reason for this attitude that all of us should have also on a daily basis and also on the ultimate basis. The reason why they constantly were like strangers and dwelt in tents and would not build a house, you see, because this is not where it's at, even though that land was given to them. But for them, in verse 10 we read, for he waited and so forth, you know, Jacob was the same and Isaac was the same and all the men of God, you know, until God gave it to them. We read, he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So he knew God is going to build a city. You see? That city is not there yet. God is preparing this city, as I mentioned last time. God is in the process of doing it, and in the process of building it, and he knew that's coming in the future. So he's looking now not only to the day when God will give the land to his descendants 430 years exactly. He's not looking to that time. He's not even looking to the time when Christ will come and reign on this earth. You see? He's looking to the end of the plan when the Father descends, you know, with heavenly Jerusalem, the one that he's building and making and preparing for his people. So he's looking for the time when the Father himself, the El Elyon that he knew of, he didn't speak to him, he spoke to the immediate God that dealt with him, Jesus Christ, the one that became Jesus Christ. And obviously, this Jesus Christ told him an awful lot about the future. So you see an awful lot of background there that is not necessarily mentioned as you go along until the end time. Yet Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the others are fully aware of the end of time, of the kingdom of God, of the plan of God, of the future. That unfortunately, as time went by, the children of Israel lost track of it and knowledge and understanding of it. And so when he comes to the end of the story in the days of Christ, when he's just about to ascend to heaven, the disciples ask him, Lord, will you restore at this time the kingdom to Israel? So they always knew what the kingdom was all about, and that it is to Israel, and where Israel is, and this is where heaven and Jerusalem descends ultimately, not just Christ when he comes, but even after that. And Israel is in the center of it. So he's looking for the time and the place and the city where the Father will dwell, where Jesus Christ will be there, where his nation, his people, his family will also be there. And so this is what we read here. And until that time, obviously he's going to regard himself, as long as he's alive on this earth, and his children were likewise, Isaac and Jacob, even though the land will be given to them later on, they're going to look upon themselves as strangers and sojourners. And God reminded Israel of the same reality. He said, look, this land is mine. You are just strangers and sojourners upon it. You see? And that's why one of the laws that he gave them, that, well, whatever land you have, you see, it is given to you. And so if you lose it, you get it back 50 years later, at the latest. And you have to remember that the land shall never be sold for forever, but only for 50 years. And you have to remember, and the reason for it is, you're just a bunch of strangers, so to speak, and sojourners. And that's the way you should consider yourself. As long as you're on the land, the ultimate is still to come, and it is in the future. So don't put your stakes, you know, all on one piece of land, which is temporary for you anyway. That is, your life is temporary, and you are strangers. This is my land. I live forever. And, of course, the idea was, there is coming a future time, a heavenly city of Jerusalem, and you're going to be in it, and you're going to be in the land of Israel also, that will be around it. That's the kingdom of God that, unfortunately, as time went by, because of blindness and ignorance on the part of Israel and Judah, everybody got mixed up, and they thought that land is up there, way up there in heaven. Heaven in Jerusalem, and everybody goes to heaven. Anyway, Abraham knows all these things, and so he rises up and considers himself as a stranger as he talks to the people of Het. And so he tells them, verse 4 again, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you. You know, you give it to me, and I'm not going to take it over, even though it's my land. That I may bury my dead out of my sight. You see? And people in those days, today it's not the same, but the burial ceremony was an important place. It was the land of their fathers. You know, everybody wanted to be buried with his fathers. It was a very important thing, unlike the way things are today. And so he wants a special territory, a special land, a special area, where he is going to be buried there. That is his wife, and then he, and then his sons, and so forth. Those things had a tremendous, great importance in the old days. And that's why later on you read in the book of Ruth that when Ruth is following her mother-in-law, she says to her, you know, where you shall be buried, I shall be buried. Now, that was a great shame in those days, and great dishonor for a person not to be able to be buried with his own family. And that was an extremely important place, you know, just like the Indians to this very day. They respect very highly, you know, the burial places of their ancestors. Many others lost the meaning for it, and the importance for it, and the appreciation for this reality. Anyway, that's what he's saying here. And mind you, this is the first time in the Bible that you read about a burial issue, and the burial ceremony, and the burial place. Not that people didn't die before that, but this is the first time that it is mentioned. And so, that's what he's saying here. And the children of Het answered Abraham, saying unto him, hear us, my Lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Now, you see, he's already very well acquainted with them. They are very well acquainted with him. And they know his position in life. And they know that he's an honorable man. And they appreciate the fact that here he comes to them, a mighty person, and a mighty prince, that if he wanted, he could have taken over the whole area. You see, had he been a man of war, like many others were, but they were all still children of peace. And that's why this time, even as God told Abraham, I'm not going to give you the land now, because the sins and iniquities of the Amorites, you know, all these people, have not come to the full. They haven't got to be that wicked as it became later on. At this point, there is still a greater measure of righteousness, because, mind you, they are still closer to the edge of Noah and Shem and all the others. That means there is still more knowledge of God in the land. And you see it in Egypt with the king who knows about God, and you see it with Abimelech, and you see it in Babylon, and you see it in many places. But gradually, you know, they depart from the faith and become more and more corrupt. And so they recognize his greatness, and so they tell him, in the choices, that is, in the choice of our sepulchres, bury your dead. In other words, take any of our own burial places, which, mind you, are extremely important to those people at the time. But they're offering it to him. You see, they're willing to part from it, not because they're afraid of him. You know, he's a mighty man, but he's a man of peace, and they know him, they love him, they appreciate him for it. And obviously, you know, you see that the wonderful relationship they have. And so they offer it to him, but he says, they tell him, none of us shall withhold from you his sepulcher, you know, his own personal one that, you know, just don't part with. That's, you know, unheard of. That you may bury your dead. And so Abraham rose up. In other words, he sits down. They all sit down, you know, on the ground. And they're sort of the elders of the people. And so he's having this discussion with them. And, you know, when you're in the Middle East, in those days especially, you recognize that all kind of things like that are done in a sort of a ceremony, and there is respect, and there is honor, and there is acknowledgement of age, and, you know, it's a totally different society, and that is, we just don't see those kind of things. And verse 7, we read, actually, we still see a measure of it in the Middle East, but we don't see it in many other areas, especially the Western world. Anyway, in verse 7, we read, and Abraham rose up. See, as long as there's, in other words, somebody stands up and he speaks, and then he sits down, and that's what happens here. And so Abraham spoke, and then he sat down for them to speak, and then he stands up again. He rises up and bowed down to the people of the land, and you see the part of the Middle Eastern ceremony there, and hospitality, and acknowledgement of age, and respect, and honor, and all that. That's why in those lands, honor is extremely important. People will give their life for it. And Abraham rose up and bowed down to the people of the land, even to the children of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, if it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me to Ephron the son of Zohar, or Zohar. In other words, one of the main leaders of the Heth there, and apparently there was a piece of land that he knew about, that belonged to this person, and he wanted them to approach this man, this leader, and speak to him. Now, of course, that leader was right there. And yet, he doesn't approach him directly. He's approaching the elders who are older than that man. Unless you understand the culture of the Middle East and everything that goes into it, you know, you miss an awful lot here, and you don't have an appreciation for it. And so, he continues here in verse 9, please speak to him that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is in the end of his field. So he's got a field, he's got his own burial place there, and he likes that place, and he's asking for it, but he's not approaching that person directly, because that's not a part of the custom. He approaches the elders, and whatever the elders, you know, they too sort of, you know, they have to agree on that, and that was a process. There are actually many peoples today that still do these kind of things. You find them in Africa, you find them in India, in Pakistan, you know, places like that, Afghanistan, where society still functions on this basis. And so he said, you speak to him for that land, the cave of Machpelah, that was the name of it, which he has, which is in the end of the field, for the full price, let him give it to me, in the midst of you for a possession of a burying place. So he said, I'll give him the full price. I don't want to take it for free, because you see, that was the custom of Abraham. As you can read earlier, when he delivered and When you think about it, you know, if you delivered the people of Sodom, when you go to war, well, you deserve something, you deserve some reward, but even then didn't want to take any, you see. And he told the king of Sodom the reason for it, why he would not, because he said, I don't want you to let on sale that I made Abraham rich, you see. So, even though everything belongs to him, he still is willing to pay for it. And that was the nature of the father of the faith. You see, he depended totally on God and not on his own strength, even though he deserved it, and it was his by right. And so, that's what he's saying here, I'll pay the full price. Verse 10, now Ephron was sitting in the midst of the children of Heth. So Ephron is sitting right there, but he cannot approach him directly until he speaks to the elders. That's a part of the custom of the time. And Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the children of Heth, even of all that went in at the gate of his city. In other words, this whole ceremony happens at the gate of the city, and that's generally where people sat, and that's where deals were made, and that's where judgment was being passed, and that was the custom of the time. Later on, you know, they build places, and they call them courthouses, and this is the original courthouse at the gate. People just sit in the open and talked and among the elders, and everybody was respectful, so there was no need for bureaucracy and a system and all that you find later on when people departed from God, and now they needed all these elaborate intricacies of way of life. In those days, you know, just went to the elders, you spoke to them, they were the leaders of the nation, you know, the people of the city, of the village, whatever it may be. And there was no need for elections and campaigns and all these things that you find later on. Anyway, it was another world. And so he speaks to them at the gate of the city, saying, Nay, my lord, hear me. The field give I thee, that is Ephron now speaking. He says, and I don't want any money. And the field I give it to you, that is therein, in the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. So, you know, in front of them, that's official. That's all there is new. You know, you need to do, you know, so, you know, sort of say you shake hands, and a word of honor meant more than anything else in the world, you see. And when people became more wicked, you know, they began to abuse even the oath and the handshake, and nothing meant anything. And that's why it got to the point where Christ told them, don't even swear, you see. It's so dishonest nowadays that even swearing doesn't mean anything, so do not even do that. And that's what he's saying here, in the presence of the sons of my people, I do it, and so that's good enough. Don't even need to sign a document. Verse 12, and Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he spoke unto Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, But if you will, I pray thee, hear me, I will give the price. So he's still insisting on paying for it. I will give you the price of the field, take it of me, and I will bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying unto him, My lord, hearken unto me, a piece of the land worth 400 shekels of silver. Now that's a lot of money, 400 shekels of silver, because for 30 pieces you could have bought a slave. So here you're talking about an awful lot of slaves that you could have bought. That's a lot of riches. And yet Abraham was not about to get it for free. He was going to pay for it. And so this is what the worth of the land, he said. So it's not just a tiny little plot, you know, 6 by 6 feet. Obviously, you're talking about an area, a sizable area, a sizable piece of land. And so it's worth 400 shekels of silver. What is it between me and you? Bury therefore your dead. And Abraham hearkened unto Ephron, and Abraham weighed to Ephron the silver, because, you know, in those days they were all coins, so he literally weighed it, which he had named in the hearing of the children of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with a merchant, something that you could use, you know, for bartering. And so the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, now Mamre, remember, is a place where Abraham dwelt earlier. He was a friend of his and confederate with him, and he used the sons of Mamre also to go to war against the kings that took Sodom and Gomorrah into captivity. And so he's still in the same area, and that's the reason why he returned to this place. He was there before that, then he went to Beersheba, then he came back. And so it was near the field of Mamre, and the cave, which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field. So you can see he buys this whole area there. And it's all his. And this is the first piece of land that Abraham owned in the land. And he paid for it with his own money, a land that to begin with belonged to him. But you see that the men of God, even though they are given possession and blessings and all that, they're not rude, they're not arrogant, they're not like the rulers of the Gentile that like to exercise dominion and authority. You see, that's contrary to the law of God. Other nations did not know this law as they should have, though to a degree there was still much greater integrity on their part and obedience to the law that they had, or the customs of the land. And so he bought the whole area and all the border thereof round about it. And all that was made sure. In other words, now they signed a document and all the men there knew about it. And so unto Abraham it was given for a possession in the presence of the children of Het before all that went in at the gate of his city. So it became an official fact for generations to come. And so it was meant to be. And yet, you see what happens today. And for a long time, that land was taken away from the children of Abraham by enemies. And to this very day, you find people there. And of course, in one sense, it's a problem today because they're all children of Abraham, even though they are not Israelites. But then the only people that were burned there, buried, were Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you see, and their wives, and so initially, and finally it ended up in the hands of the children of Israel. And so it was known that only Israelites are to be buried there, even though the patriarch, the father, Abraham, is the father of all many others. And Isaac was also the father not only of Jacob, but also of Esau. And yet only Israelites, it was known, were in that land. And to begin with, the whole land was given to Israel, finally, and not to any others. And yet today, because of the iniquities and sins, unfortunately, of Judah, that land is not even theirs. It was given back to the Palestinians. And so you see a link there, between 4,000 years ago, what happened, and between what is happening today. And so a lot of Jews today are claiming that. They say, look, Father Abraham bought it with his own money, and this land is ours. You see, we are the inheritance. Of course, the Arabs don't care much about it. And so they buried, and after this, in verse 19 we read, and after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre. The name, the same is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the children of Het. So here is a repetition of the legality of the whole transaction. And so had the children of Israel been obedient all the time, this land would have been constantly in their hands in the past 4,000 years, in other words, from that time. And even when the children of Israel were in Egypt, mind you, where is it that Jacob buried? He was buried there, in this very place. So they brought him back all the way from Egypt, back to the old land to be buried, because that was the burial place of all the patriarchs. And later on, in other places where the other children of Israel lived, But this whole area would have remained in their hands to this very day, from generation to generation, 4,000-year burial place. And yet because of iniquity and wickedness on the part of the children of Israel, that is not the case. And so when Jacob died, we read in later on in the book of Exodus, actually at the end of this book, that God, in other words, when Jacob died, he was buried and brought over here by Joseph, but then later on when Joseph died in the book of Exodus, beginning of the chapter, before he died, he commanded and made his brothers swear to him that they would take his bones when they come out and bring it to this very place. And so here it is, 400 years down the road, 430 years down the road, you can still see the children of Israel still regarding this place as the burial place, and everybody else around it knew. And so when they brought Jacob back, the Canaanites didn't say, hey, what are you doing here, you Egyptians, this land doesn't belong to you. Well, everybody knew this land belongs to Abraham and to his descendants. And so naturally, when Joseph comes with his father's body, and all the brothers with him, and all the Egyptians come with him. You know, the Canaanites don't get alarmed about it. They don't think that this is an invasion. They come over there, and they stay there, and they mourn there for quite a long time. And probably even the locals that have known, the patriarchs probably came and mourned with them, realizing, because of the respect and honor to this patriarch, that these are his descendants. And so it's very interesting the way things happen. And you see it in other places where God and people have considered a burial place a very important one. So one of the curses would be is that your bones will be taken away out of your burial place and thrown away. And that's exactly what some people did. And in contrast, you know, you will hear oftentimes in the scriptures about certain kings or certain good people that were buried in good old age with their fathers. And many of the kings of Israel that were righteous, that were buried with their fathers, and then some cases we hear about some kings that were not righteous, that were wicked, and it says very plainly there, and that was known by all, and it was a very great shame, that those people were not buried with their fathers. And so burial place was extremely important. Anyway, this is the end here. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.